This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The NCAA basketball tournaments, better known as March Madness, get underway in a couple of weeks and are certain to attract enormous crowds in the arenas and on TV. The amount of money involved is in proportion. Just 3 months ago, it was college football and the bowl games, and while the upcoming College World Series isn't on the same level, the annual baseball tournament gets bigger every year. Amid the piles of money, the lofty ratings, the glitz and glory, it's sometimes hard to remember that the players are students. The competition is so fierce and the pressure to win so great that coaches and college administrators sometimes bend and break the rules on recruiting and academic eligibility. The rules on both, though, have changed. In a little more than 2 years as president of the NCAA, Miles Brand has helped to develop new restrictions on recruiting, and there are new and tougher academic standards which have some teeth. Those that do not measure up will face escalating punishments, fewer scholarships, bans on postseason play, or possibly even expulsion from the NCAA. Later in the program, a bid to buy the National Hockey League, the whole thing, and we'll go to Syracuse University to an exhibition of portraits of American troops killed in Iraq. But first, college sports. If you have questions for Miles Brand about the economics, the ethics, or the purpose of collegiate athletics, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Miles Brand joins us now from the studios of member station WFYI in Indianapolis, and it's nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Tell us about this new academic progress report. What do you hope to achieve with it?
We are putting in place, as you rightly said at the beginning, tougher standards, including sanctions, to assure that our student athletes get every opportunity to get a fine education at the college or university that they're at and graduate. We are measuring now in real time, semester by semester, the progress a student athlete makes. Are they remaining eligible to play, and are they being retained? And those are the two major issues that determine graduation. So each team gets a score now, and based on that score and our expectations, our national expectations, a team is either doing fine or they have a problem. We've sent out notices to every team through their schools just recently this past week to warn those who have not who are not performing well. As a result, they have 1 year to begin to make repairs. If not, we'll begin to take away scholarships. A couple years from now, when we get more data, we'll undertake looking at the graduation rate, which we're calling a graduate success rate, differs from the federally mandated rate in that it takes into account transfers in and transfers out, where the federal rate doesn't. And there we'll have even more serious penalties, not just loss of scholarships, but as you pointed out earlier, prohibitions about playing in the postseason, and in the very extreme cases for the outliers, potentially loss of the ability to participate in NCAA events.
Based on this first report card, if you will, there's an awful lot of schools and an awful lot of programs that would be in trouble.
About 7% of all the teams that play in Division I, the highest division in the NCAA, are below what we expect. We have a APR cutoff score of 925.
Which more or less roughly correlates to a 50% graduation rate?
That's right. It's a number that we've calculated, and just like an SAT score, if I said 1150, if you didn't know the context, you wouldn't know what it meant. Mm-hmm. A 925 correlates approximately to the federal rate of 50%. That'll vary from year to year, but that's an approximation. In the future, when we use our graduate success rate, the GSR, the correlation will be a little different. But this is a way to get a hook on it right now. And so basically, those teams that are not performing at that level are at risk of losing scholarships unless they change their behaviors.
Is this a pass-fail system also? If you're 926, you're okay. 924, you're not?
Approximately that. We have room for waivers in special cases, but it's pass-fail, yes. Mm-hmm. Now, for smaller teams, particularly in the first couple of years, there's going to be a margin of error because we just don't have enough data points. But as time goes on in the next several years, it will be pass-fail, just as you say.
Now, you say 7% of the programs. As you go through the actual numbers on these report cards, Oh, the water polo, rifle, wrestling, lacrosse, all those teams are in pretty good shape. Really, what you're talking about is big-time college sports. Those 7% are very heavily concentrated in baseball, basketball, and football.
That's exactly right. And the women's sports tend to do far better than the men's sports. And in the men's sports, the most highly visible sports, football, baseball, and basketball, in that order, are most affected. So basically speaking, about 30% of the football teams in Division I are open to this penalty of loss of scholarships, approximately 25% of the baseball teams, and approximately 20% of the basketball teams. Now, if you get a bad score, what this means, if you get under 925, what this means is that if a student athlete in the following year leaves your program academically ineligible, flunks out in Common Jordan, then you cannot replace that student-athlete for a year.
So you lose a scholarship.
Yeah. And you lose a scholarship.
That's a serious business for college athletics.
Absolutely a serious business. If you want to be competitive as a team, you have to be able to use your limited number of scholarships. There are only 13 scholarships in men's basketball. While we've put a 10% limit on it, or for basketball that would be 2, and, mm-hmm. and in football it would be 9, those matter in terms of keeping a team competitive.
Now,
here's the key point. The key point is that not only are we holding student-athletes accountable, as we've always done through eligibility requirements, we're now holding teams and schools accountable for the success, academic success of the athletes.
Now, it's no coincidence, is it, that those three sports, men's basketball, baseball, and football, those are the big money sports?
Particularly men's basketball and football are the ones that generate the revenue through broadcast media. Absolutely.
Let's get some callers on the line. If you'd have some questions for Miles Brand, the president of the NCAA, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And we'll talk with Ron, and Ron's on the line with us from Paducah, Kentucky.
Yes, I appreciate you taking my call. My question concerning this program is that I can understand the academic standards and graduation rates are being upgraded, so to speak. But does this take into account the academic, the rigorousness of the academic programs the athletes are involved in? For example, you often hear people being announced as majoring in, quote, general studies, whereas others are majoring, that have scholarships, have to major in engineering or one of the sciences or literature. And so is this a little bit artificial, is my question, because of the sometimes lax academic, lax rigor of the academic program for the athletes? And I'll take my answer off the line.
Okay, Ron, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's be careful in what we accuse our colleges and universities of doing. All these programs are open to all students, not just student-athletes. Not every student in a fine university and college takes engineering or nuclear physics. Some take other courses of study, which by some accounts, not necessarily the case, but some accounts are easier. Student-athletes not only have to take these courses, but they have to make genuine progress towards a degree. You remember we used to talk about in the old days you would get a degree or at least finish your eligibility in a college, and you wouldn't be able to read and write if you were a student-athlete. Those days are over. You have to have a genuine degree program that all other students are able to take, and you have to make 20% progress per year, 40% by your sophomore year, 60% by your junior year, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Progress towards a degree. So remaining eligible by just taking easy courses, basket weaving as it's sometimes called, is no longer permissible. We have upped the bar, and we're expecting our student athletes to take the same courses in pretty much the same level of distribution that the general student body is taking.
And there has been criticism, as I'm sure you know, about the emphasis on retention. A great college basketball program, freshmen, sophomores could be, in the NBA draft and making a lot of money the next year. Would that punish those teams because those guys didn't go on to graduation?
There are 5,000, let's take men's basketball, 5,000 student athletes playing men's basketball right now. About 50 people will make the NBA each year. About half of those, 25 or either foreign students, are coming right out of high school. So about 25 students who are underclassmen or graduates will go from college into the NBA. Half of them will probably be graduates. Half of them will be freshmen or sophomores. 25 out of 5,000, that's not enough to account for the problems we have in graduation rates. There's It's a myth that we think everyone is going into the NBA. Actually, only a small handful go into the NBA. Others drop out of school. They're the ones we're interested in. They don't make professional sports teams, and they don't graduate from college. They become part of a lost generation. This program is addressed primarily to those students who need the education for the rest of their lives, not the small handful that will become multimillionaires.
Let's call talk with now Tony, and Tony's with us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Tony. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I go to one of the big universities, and I take a lot of classes. I've had I've got almost 100 credit hours, and I never see any of the students in classes. I've had one class so far where we had three football students in there, and let's just say I could very easily say that they would never, ever get into the actual program in the business program.
So you never see the athletes, the football players in class?
They start out the semester in the class, but most of them never, none of the athletes, they're all just down at the centers where the hangout is,
mm-hmm.
without being too specific, because I go to one of the universities, and they really don't contribute. And as far as, like, the academic requirements, they're not nearly strict enough. If they can't get a 3.0, then most of the university schools, you're not going to get into a program unless they're getting special treatment. So the academic requirement should be at least a 2.0. I mean, requiring a student-athlete to get C's is probably not too much of a requirement.
Okay. Tony, I'm going to thank you for the call, and we're running out of time in this segment, so we'll
okay.
Have Miles Brand address your question when we come back from the break, okay?
Thanks.
Appreciate it. We'll take a short break when we return. More on holding colleges and universities accountable for educating student-athletes. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, the phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today with the president of the NCAA, Miles Brand. He's getting tough on student-athletes. You're invited to join the conversation. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email us, totn@npr.org, should there be sanctions when college sports programs fail to meet academic standards. And just before the break, we had a caller named Tony who's saying that he, and he is certainly not the only one, says on his campus he never sees college football players in class. This is a continuing problem, even if there's a perception of widespread cheating going on.
Yeah, I think we have to be very careful about being biased against student athletes. The vast, vast majority of them are hardworking students carrying a full academic load as well as participating in college sports. We have to be careful about a bias against refusing to give them the benefit of the doubt. But having said that, are there some cases, probably far less than we think there are, but are there some cases in which this is going on? No doubt. To the extent that that's been going on, we've put in rules and sanctions to change that behavior. We require GPAs semester by semester. We require progress towards a degree, so you graduate in 5 years or less. We require now that you have higher standards coming into the institution so that you're prepared to take college courses. And we're holding, and this is the new part, we're holding teams accountable as well. Teams will lose scholarships. Therefore, the coach and the rest of the team is going to help that one student, make sure that one student succeeds academically. You can't just run off without affecting the rest of the team. And so I think we're putting in place the accountability measures and the sanctions that are necessary to assure individual student athletes can take advantage of their academic experience.
Before we go too much further, I did want to ask you about an incident in Philadelphia a couple of weeks ago now. This involved the Hall of Fame men's basketball coach at Temple University, John Chaney, who was upset about some rough play that he thought was not being called by the officials and put into the game a young man he himself described as a goon who committed 5 fouls in 4 minutes and on the last one threw an opposing player from St. Joe's University to the floor and broke his arm. John Chaney has now been suspended for the remainder of the year. This is not strictly the NCAA's purview, but this is a black eye to the sport.
Human nature being what it is, whether it's athletics, business, the church, education, public service, there will always be people who do what they ought not to do. That's just the nature of the life we all lead. The fact of the matter is this is clearly a case of unsportsmanship-like behavior. The school, which is the appropriate body to sanction and take action, has done so. And Coach Chaney, in fact, has apologized more than once for this and no doubt regrets what he did. Whatever other actions being taken is up to the individual school. The NCAA is a membership organization, doesn't hire or fire coaches, nor does it have the ability, or should it have the ability, to sanction individual coaches. That really must rely with the school's president and their board of trustees. That's where the authority lies, and that's where the responsibility lies.
The president of the NCAA is a job that has an awful lot of responsibility, but not necessarily an awful lot of authority, does it?
I'd like to say I'm not the czar of college sports. But I do have the ability to work with our members, whether they're the coaches or the athletic directors, certainly the presidents, to form a set of principles and rules which we can, through various sanctioning measures, enforce that talk about academic performance, that talk about a competitive level playing field, that give student athletes every opportunity while in school to get a good education and to take the steps necessary to assure that that occurs. So it's not powerless, but it's not the same as being a commissioner of a professional league, for example, in which I would have the authority then to sanction coaches or individual players. Most of the authority here does continue to lie with the schools, and I think that's appropriate.
Let's get another caller on the line. Donna is with us from Ashland, Oregon.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm calling somewhat in defense of the athletes. My niece was recently recruited by Duke to run track for them, and this is her first year there, and I've been out to visit her there, and I have a whole new respect for the athlete. She is an honor student. She carries a full load, and she also has what I consider a full-time job as an athlete there. It seems a lot to ask. I mean, I'm just really proud of them and what they do.
And Donna's niece, Miles Brand, is, I think like the majority of scholar-athlete is a term that can evoke a snort when you're talking about the big-time college programs. But in the vast majority of cases and the vast majority of programs, Donna's niece is really the story, isn't she?
That's absolutely right. There are 360,000 student-athletes in our colleges and universities across the nation. The vast, vast majority of them are doing well. In fact, the graduation rate for student-athletes is higher than the general student body. And that goes whether you're looking at female students or male students. And the same thing holds for each ethnic group as well. Student-athletes work hard at what they're doing. Here's an interesting fact. When you're looking at football players tend to do better academically during the fall when their teams are working hard than in the spring. How can that be? How can they do better academically when they're also carrying all this load of practicing and playing the games? Well, the fact is one of the things student-athletes learn to do very well is manage their time. And they learn how to be focused and committed to what they're doing. And it shows. It's a great life experience. I think this young woman is gaining by it. And it will be a life experience that carries on well past their college education.
Donna, wish your niece the best in both her pursuits.
Oh, thank you so much.
We appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Here's an email question from Jean Hay. I hear such disparate information on this question, I wanted to go to the top. Do the major NCAA Division I football teams earn or lose money for their universities?
That's a very good question. There's facts and myth. The myth is that the vast majority earn money. That is a myth and it's false. There are about 350 Division I schools. About a little less than 300 play football. Of those, maybe 40 will claim to earn money for their schools. The fact of the matter is that probably only about a dozen do. So most athletic programs, including the high-visibility Division I's, most of them, when you take everything into account, including facilities, bonded indebtedness, travel, and so on, when you take all that into account, most of them lose money, which is okay. That's not a problem because what these entities do is that they get money through football and men's basketball and then use that to support the participation of many other student-athletes in other sports.
I know one thing that you've also been interested in doing, though, again, your power is not unlimited, as you mentioned, is to restrain spending, not to decrease it, not to even freeze it, but to restrain the increase in spending, particularly on big-ticket items like a new football stadium.
I think that's right. The next area that the NCAA has to begin to look at is what I call fiscal responsibility. We want to make sure that our athletic programs are not spending at a rate so far above the general university rate that they're creating financial problems for the institution as a whole. I'm not interested in cutting back. I'm not even interested in stopping the growth. What I am concerned about, and everyone should be concerned about, is that if the growth rate of college sports is much quicker, faster than the growth rate of the general university, it puts that institution at risk, particularly if a lot of the expenditures these days are in bonded indebtedness for new facilities, because then you're taking on a 20 or 30-year mortgage, as it were. And if the revenues don't continue at the same rate as they are now, the university as a whole could be at risk financially.
Mm. Let's get another caller in. Mark joins us from Chicago.
Yeah, hi. My question's for Dr. Brand. A few years ago, while you were president of Indiana University, there were reports that you were in favor of making intercollegiate athletics, eliminating them and making them intramural only, kind of similar to what Vanderbilt University was thinking about doing a few years ago. Now that you're president of the NCAA, which is a member institution of intercollegiate athletics, what is your position on that now?
And that initial report was false. It was generated by my critics, perhaps friends of a former basketball coach. There was no truth to that whatsoever. I've always been an advocate for intercollegiate athletics. I've always been an advocate for what intercollegiate athletics can do for student athletes and what it could do for the university. I've carried that consistently through all my academic positions and certainly into the NCAA.
Mark, thank you. Bye-bye. Let's talk now with Omesh. Omesh is with us from Fremont, California.
Yeah, hi. I was actually going to talk about students not being compensated sufficiently, but a remark just made earlier in the in this program caught my attention. Neil, you brought about the fact that the Temple coach, John Chaney had been sort of suitably reprimanded. But what was interesting was he was allowed to design his own punishment initially, self-imposed one-game suspension, where he was allowed to coach the students in practice, but not in the field, not in the court, which was later extended, I think, again, by himself, when it was discovered that the injury to the student who was hurt was much more serious. Now, which other, arena do we have a person who commits sort of a violation allowed to design his own punishment? And Dr. Brand's suggestion that, he doesn't have a say in the matter, or at least some leverage or some authority, is rather disappointing. He at least has a moral authority to suggest that something like this was outrageous and should not be tolerated. And in fact, it suggests that the school management was very lax. So at least with respect to that point, the NCAA should have some sort of say in the matter.
Dr. Brand?
I think we have to be very careful not to play the indoor game of second-guessing what's going on when coaches or student-athletes misbehave. We don't know all the context. We don't know the facts. We don't know the conversation that took place, for example, between the coach and the president of the administration, and who's responsible for designing the particular punishment. The key point is that the authority lies with the school and its president, and that's where the decision-making must be. Of course, this was an unsportsmanlike act. Of course, this was unacceptable behavior. The coach readily admitted he has done, as we all know, a lifelong things for young men that have been very productive, but he overstepped the bounds here, and the school set a punishment. What that punishment should be needs to be set by that institution. The NCAA is a national organization. It doesn't have the ability nor the authority, because it's not ceded to it by the institutions, to be able to design those punishments. Sports commentators and others can second-guess a lot, but I think the authority and the decision lies with the school.
Well, one factor in this was John Chaney, in a news conference before that game, said, hey, if they don't call these rough fouls, I'm going to send in a goon. Then he did it, and in a news conference after the game, he said he had done that. So he had, this was something that he advertised. Other coaches may have done similar kinds of things under, but they didn't necessarily hold a news conference to say they were going to do it and admit afterwards that they did it.
This is not a behavior which we approve of and recommend. That's clearly the case. It's not acceptable behavior, and he has been sanctioned for it. That kind of approach to playing basketball is unsportsmanlike and, in fact, is harmful to the game, not just the individuals who play it. It gives all of sports, not just college sports, a bad name. And I know that the coach regrets it and indeed has been punished.
Amesh, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. Allie's calling us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hi, I have a couple comments. I played tennis at a large university in North Carolina, and we actually had the highest GPA out of all of the athletic teams at the school. And I just wanted to say, I think the new restrictions and guidelines you guys are putting on the schools is very good. However, I do believe it is the coach. It's up to the coach to really guide us and really keep on us about our grades. I think we had the highest GPA because our coach was in our face all the time. And for those who weren't performing well, she made sure they were in study hall. And I think that's why, and I understand that you are just the NCAA and you can't control these coaches per se. It's up to the president. But it wasn't the athletic directors or the counselors that were in our face every day. It was our coaches. And she was a great coach, and that's why we had a really high GPA.
I think that's a very important point. Coaches play a central role. They are teachers and mentors as well as athletic coaches. And that includes what the student athletes tend to do academically, certainly their motivation and their goals. What we're doing now by holding teams and schools accountable is saying that if the coach doesn't act as this particular coach has that was described, then they're liable to lose a scholarship. And that's going to affect the competitiveness of the team. It's going to affect, as a result, what the coach's job position is and how well his win-loss record is. We're putting the pressure on the coaches, on the athletic directors, as well as we have in the past in the student athletes. And I think the coaches do have a critically important role to play. The good news is that the vast majority of coaches really take their job as teachers and mentors seriously. The vast majority of coaches want their student-athletes to succeed, not just in the games they play, but academically, and many coaches follow their student-athletes after school and want to make sure they succeed in life as well.
Allie, thanks. Here's an email question. What about the students who receive athletic scholarships then get hurt? They lose their scholarship, and for many, it makes it hard to stay at the major university despite their academics. What about the students who get to school and find they cannot balance the rigors of academic studies and athletic programs?
Well, as for student athletes who get hurt, they usually keep their scholarships, I think. And we are looking at ways to extend the scholarship beyond 1 year. So that rarely happens, and when it does happen, we tend to look into it. Student athletes who come to school and find that they can't both do academics and athletics, and that happens in a few cases, then I think they have to make the choice and focus in on their academics, they lose their scholarship, which means instead of working 20 hours at their sport, they may have to work 20 hours or at least part-time or take out a student loan in order to succeed in academics while not getting the scholarship from the athletic department. As we all know today, financial issues should not stop anyone from going to college. While their scholarships may not be available, various kinds of financial aid, including federal student loan programs, do make it possible for students to attend college, even if they're not athletes.
When we come back from a short break, we'll continue our conversation with Miles Brand, the president of the NCAA. Also, we'll talk about a bid to buy the National Hockey League, plus a new exhibit of portraits of soldiers killed in Iraq. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow it's Science Friday. Ira Flatow will be here with a look at the president's proposed budget for ocean-related research, plus new discoveries at the ocean's deepest depths. That's all tomorrow on Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. And now we continue our discussion with the president of the NCAA, Miles Brand, who's with us from Indianapolis. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address, totn@npr.org. We're talking primarily about new and tougher academic standards that are being imposed on college sports programs, and there have been a lot of phone calls about it. There are a couple more. Let's talk with Mike. Mike's with us from Springfield, Massachusetts.
Hi, how are you guys?
Very well, thanks.
Good. My question is, I was a Division I student athlete. I wrestled from New Jersey, and I was always taught that your primary objective, obviously, is education, and that was my primary responsibility. And my question is why should the sport be responsible for the student when the individual themselves should be responsible for their academics? I'll take this answer offline. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
It's a shared responsibility. Just as if you're a regular student, you have a responsibility as a student to study and go to class and do well. But the teacher also has a responsibility to make sure that you're well-motivated as well as making sure he or she conveys the correct information. Similarly, the coach has a responsibility as well as the student. It is a shared opportunity. It takes a whole university to educate a student, to coin a phrase. So it's not just the individual that has a responsibility, but the coach as a mentor, as a teacher, should both motivate and encourage students to graduate and to do well academically.
Also, the way this program is structured, does it assume that if all of these things accumulate and students leave or don't graduate and the number falls below that 925 number, the roughly 50% graduation rate, that there's a pattern here and that the school and the sports program specifically are responsible for that pattern?
Yeah, that's exactly right. These APR numbers are what we call contemporaneous or immediate penalties. As we get data over the next several years, where we get the true outliers, where we get teams that habitually don't graduate their students, then the schools are supposed to take action. But in fact, we will, at the national level, provide sanctions for that team and eventually the school if they don't correct the situation. So it does become additive over time. We are looking in the case of the long-term historical penalties, as it were, we're looking for those outliers who can't correct the problem, for the coaches of the teams in which the student-athletes really aren't getting a fair shake at getting an education. And for that, we do have very serious sanctions, and we'll change that. So you're quite right. The school has a responsibility as addition to the team, the coach, and the AD.
Let's talk now with Brian. He's calling from Rockville, Maryland.
Hi, how are you doing?
Okay.
Good segment. Two things. One, it just seems that this 50% graduation rate within 5 years is, with all due respect, a bit of a joke. I mean, if somebody were to get 50% on, let's say, a test or an exam in school, that's a failing grade. So I don't see how this is really any sort of a meaningful standard. And second of all, for those sort of the recidivists or the habitually underperforming programs, which we all know are the big time men's football, basketball, and baseball, I have a solution to all this. Why don't we just make these semi-pro teams and say that they're going to be the, you know, Michigan, whoever, Wolverine semi-pro team, because that's what essentially they are. I mean, these are not student athletes. Everybody knows that. They have their dorms they live in. They live these incredibly closeted, sequestered lives. They're not part of the student body. They get these tutors to do their homework for them, to write their papers, and they're not students in any way, shape, or form. So why don't we just have, you know, get rid of these programs once and for all and call them semi-pro teams, and people can still support them. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brian.
First of all, the students in all Division I schools graduate overall on average at 60%. Student-athletes overall graduate at 62%. We're setting a floor, a minimum of 50%, and we expect people to do better than that. But again, student-athletes graduate at a better rate than the general student body. Many things that this caller said are just plain false. There are not special dorms. They're not coddled in the way it's expected. And I think if you do make the high-visibility teams, football, men's basketball, semi-pros, and take them outside the university, I think you lose something very important. The vast majority of student-athletes, even in these sports, have no chance of turning pro. What they're doing is they're going to school for educational developmental activities in sports, which they enjoy and get life skills from, as well as their academic opportunities in certain clear academic majors. Why throw out the baby with the bathwater? Let's correct the problems. Their problems are not nearly at the level that this reporter, this caller suggested. But we do have some problems. Let's correct the problems, and let's take advantage of the good parts of college athletics, which really do benefit these individual student athletes. It is part of their experience of growing up. It's part of their experience of becoming people who are committed to hard work, who are committed to teamwork, who become good citizens and professionals when they leave school. There's a good rate of success for both men and women who have participated in sports and gone on to other things.
Miles Brand, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Miles Brand is the president of the National Collegiate Athletic Association and joined us from the studios of member station WFYI in Indianapolis, Indiana.